This is the Disability Visibility Podcast with your host, Alice Wong.
Hey there. Welcome to the Disability Visibility Podcast. Conversations on disability politics, culture, and media. I'm your host, Alice Wong. Today's episode is about Asian American women and mental health, with guests Emily Wu Truo and Jessica Jimeno. You'll hear Emily and Jessica talk about their personal stories, experiences within Asian American communities, and their mental health advocacy. A few notes before we start. Emily, Jessica, and I share our personal perspectives on Asian American mental health, and in no way are we representing the entire community. Asian Americans are incredibly diverse by language, culture, and nationality. And what we talk about is one small part of a larger complex issue. Also, please be aware that there will be discussions of suicide and suicide attempts. For help, call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. They offer services in 150 languages, and there's a chat option if talking isn't your thing. Are you ready? Away we go!
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So, Jessica and Emily, thank you so much for being on my podcast today. I am so excited to talk to you both. Why don't you both, I guess, introduce yourselves? Emily, do you want to go first?
So, I've been a mental health advocate for over the last 4 years or so. And I wanted to start speaking out about this because as a suicide attempt survivor myself, I wanted to be open with my own dialogue around my own family. And I mean, my parents had a hard time. And I think that trying to be open and vocal about this with my own family has been hard. I think it's very much similar to the LGBTQ coming out process when parents just don't have the words to be able to have a safe space for their children to be able to talk about what's really on their heart. So one of the reasons why I advocate so much is because I want to bridge the gap between our Asian elders who may not have had those conversations when they were growing up, but also being able to articulate my own story when I was growing up and to communicate what I went through to the older generation so that their own kids don't go through the similar experiences that I went through and what many Asian American youth go through when they just feel like they don't know. They have to put up a front. They have to wear this mask and show that, oh, I have it all together, when really inside that they don't.
Well, thank you, Emily. And I definitely would love to hear more details about your story. Yeah, more about your family after Jessica's introduction.
Hi, Alice. So my story with bipolar disorder, so I've worked in mental health nonprofit, and I write and speak about getting stuff done when you're depressed. But my story with bipolar disorder, I struggled with symptoms of depression and what I would later know as hypomania my whole life. And the earliest depression I can remember, I was 8 years old and we were going to school, and I just had this, like, I should preface this by saying I had a really happy childhood. So I grew up in this Filipino family with a lot of cousins, where it's like, it's like the holidays all the time, which I like that, but I didn't have a vocabulary to describe mental illness. And so I remember my first suicidal depression, and I didn't know the word depression. I was 8, and I had this feeling, all of a sudden I felt hopeless for no reason. And I remember thinking, why am I going to school? Why did we go to school? Why did we go to work? What is the point of anything? What is the point of life? And then those moments were so brief, mercifully, in my childhood, but then they became longer when I was a teenager. They stretched to hours, sometimes weeks, and I would cry for no reason at all. And I was especially depressed in the winter, and then I'd get better for no reason at all. And during the times that I would later learn I was hypomanic, I couldn't sleep. It would take me like 6 hours to fall asleep. And then my senior year, I was tired of feeling this way, and I asked my parents for help. I knew I was depressed, and that's really all I knew about mental illness. And we went to an Asian American church, and it was half Korean, half Filipino, and our Korean pastor, he was a doctor. And so as my parents tell me this, they say the reason they asked him for help was not because he was a pastor, but because he was a doctor. And so he said of my depression, he said, this is nothing. This is just teenage angst. It will go away. And so we did nothing. And then I went to college in my freshman year. A friend from back home died by suicide, and she had bipolar disorder. And so this prompted me to research the illness. I forced myself, after spending a week in bed, I dragged myself to the library, read books about this bipolar disorder, and I recognized half the symptoms in myself. And I saw the campus psychiatrist who diagnosed me with bipolar 2. And I got a second opinion, which confirmed the diagnosis. And it's not been easy, but you know, I was 18 then, I'm in my early 30s now, and life is so much better than what I could have dreamed it would be. I'm so glad to be alive. And you know, when you get a diagnosis, for me, it was the beginning of freedom after fighting this nameless, faceless enemy for so long.
That's really powerful. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, you know, when you're especially a child and you're experiencing something, it's like already you're just a kid and you kind of are just kind of processing it, not really knowing what to do with it. You know, so many people think about mental health in terms of, you know, young adults and, you know, adults, but they often don't think about how it starts often in childhood. So what was that like, Jessica, in terms of just realizing as a kid that something was different and something was going on?
Well, the thing is, I didn't realize something was different because I didn't have the vocabulary to articulate it. And I think that's why it's so important now that we give people a vocabulary to talk about mental illness, even if they don't have a problem, so that if a problem arises in themselves or others, that they can ask for help. So not being able to have any, you know, description of what was going on, I thought everybody felt that way at times. I thought that was like normal. And then my senior year of high school, when I'd asked for help, it was starting to click that, you know, okay, there's this thing called depression and I think I have it. I'm pretty sure I have it. Just not exactly sure what kind of depression. And you know, the thing about hypomania, not being able to fall asleep. So I am an only child, and I didn't know until I went to college that it wasn't normal to take 5 hours to fall asleep when I had a roommate. Because the only times you're out, you see friends fall asleep is like at sleepovers, and people don't go to sleep, you know, at sleepovers. So I thought that was normal until I saw my college roommate go to sleep at will. And I was like, wait a minute, not everybody takes 5 hours to go to sleep every other night. That's not normal. I thought, you know.
And let's talk about language, because I think, you know, we all need kind of vocabulary in order to really articulate and just identify what's happening. And, you know, especially within, you know, Asian American communities, you know, with our elders, with people who are new to the country, to people who don't speak English, there's another divide in terms of terminology, because what we think of as depression in, you know, America is very different, let's say, in Mandarin or Tagalog. You know, are the terms for actual, you know, mental disabilities really, sometimes they don't exist, sometimes they're a translation that's a little bit different. So would you both like to share any thoughts in terms of just talking with your family and your relatives and how that translates or doesn't translate?
Well, I think when I was growing up, what I grew up with was mostly, you know, don't share your problems with other people or else you'll bring shame to yourself and the family. And so that, you know, that already in itself would prevent me from trying to openly share how I was feeling. I mean, I think I was able to try to articulate myself even as early as junior high. I also had those existential questions like Jessica had too. You know, what is the point of life? And I wanted to have those deep conversations and get to know and spend time with my parents, but I think that given their own upbringing, it was hard for them to be able to do those kinds of things and express themselves emotionally. Like, they went to the Harvard of Taiwan, and so I'm like, how do I even compete with that, or if that's what they want of me, and the traditional Asians who want their kids to have straight A's. And it's sometimes when there is that language gap and communication, emotional communication gap, it's hard for kids to know and process what it is that their parents want for them. And so we start to like believe in lies as we grow up, and, you know, feeling like we're not good enough and that our parents aren't proud of us. And it drives that negative self-talk that we grow up with.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, for so many Asian Americans, the bottle of minority myth, you know, this idea that we have to excel, we have to, you know, make our families proud, we have to, you know, hold up some sort of standard, is really destructive for a lot of Asian Americans. And I think in a lot of ways it causes a lot of mental health issues because it's absolutely unrealistic.
I think for me, when I sought help and I was 18, and I was worried about what my parents would think of me when I started seeing the campus psychiatrist, and it's probably the best decision I've ever made in my life, but I had to decide that I care more about being alive than what I care about anyone's opinion of me, including my parents. And that's big when you're, you know, when you're an Asian American, the opinion of your parents means a lot to you. And like, looking back at that time, my mom says the thing that makes her most proud of me is that I got help on my own. And I think that it's really hard to see past all the conditioning, you know, model minority and otherwise, but if you can push past it, it's a great thing. The other thing I would say about, one thing that helps as far as, you know, cultural gaps, is that Asians trust doctors a lot. And, you know, I've interviewed Dr. Lillian Shin before, and she's an expert on Asian American mental health. And one thing she says is that when a doctor delivers the diagnosis to the parents or the family members, extent, you know, whatever the relatives, they take it more seriously. So I didn't know this when I was 18. I was just scared and nervous, but I actually didn't tell my parents because I was so nervous what they would say. And I remember I already tried to tell them I was depressed in the past. And I actually had the campus psychiatrist call them to tell them I was diagnosed with bipolar 2. And it makes it more official for a lot of Asian families. And I think one of the things that's most helpful is when you connect people with mental health professionals, therapists, and psychiatrists who speak the language. Because there are instances where people want to be helpful, or they would be helpful if they knew, but nobody has ever explained it to them.
Yeah, and there's also the flip side as well, where there are going to be people with mental health disabilities or invisible disabilities or other kinds of disabilities where they may never receive a diagnosis. And that makes it all the more kind of difficult to articulate and to be believed. I think that's the thing that, you know, most people who are, you know, who have disabilities or who have any sort of, you know, mental illness is just to be believed and to be heard and to be, you know, accepted. And that's really tough because sometimes, you know, for some reason, you know, with a lot of reasons with mental health, people just don't, because they can't see it somehow. You know, oftentimes they don't believe it. And that's so, you know, disheartening, I think. Have you had any experiences with that?
Well, when I don't need accommodations right now for the bipolar disorder, as far as my job, but when I was in college, I learned how to ask for accommodations. It was a super important skill. And I remember my first semester, I transferred to Northwestern University. I was a sophomore, and I only knew at that point that I had bipolar disorder for a year. And I actually missed one of my very first final exams because it was a midterm. I missed one of my first exams because I was depressed, and I just missed it. And I didn't know what to do, and I didn't tell the professor I had bipolar disorder. I was freaking out, obviously. I told him I missed the exam. Could I have another chance? And he said, absolutely not. He was going to fail me. And then my counselor at the time, I was scared. I was 19. She happened to have a daughter with a mental illness. And she gave me all these tips. Like, she talked to my professor for me, but then she taught me how to advocate for myself. And that was a huge turning point, because it's not that the bipolar disorder went away, but I knew how to ask for accommodations, like how to prepare in advance. You know, if you're starting to feel depressed, ask for an extension on the paper. Don't wait until the night before the paper is due. Things like that.
Do you find that, this is for both of you, do you still find any like hesitation or difficulty in terms of just disclosing your, you know, who you are and your full identities or with your mental health disabilities? Or do you feel like that's, you know, something that's a big part of who you are now? Do you have any stories to share about, I guess, disclosing, you know, your disability identity with people around you?
Yeah. When I was just starting to become a mental health advocate and going to all of the meetings that would revolve around Asian American mental health, there was a legislative briefing, and I was just so excited because, like, at the time, I had never heard of anyone having any public forum talking about Asian American mental health. And so at the end of the forum, they asked if anyone would like to come up to the stage, and that's when I decided to disclose, because I had been holding on to so much pain all my life that I wanted to be able to be a voice for other Asian American children who grew up feeling like they couldn't open up for a really long time. And And so I went up to the podium and I said, I will not end my life because I have a story to share. The more we talk about mental health, mental illness, suicide, the more we will alleviate the stigma. There is no shame. There is no shame.
It's a myth that Asian Americans and young Asian Americans are more depressed than our white counterparts. We suffer from depression at the same rates, but the problem is we seek help less. And so the problem is likely to get worse, just like with anything, if you don't get help. And so that's what leads to, you know, in the worst case scenario, suicide, or, you know, even being unhappy, miserable for the rest of your life is also a tragedy. And so crucially, we need to seek help, and there's lots of factors in that. Cultural competency training, so that when people seek help, but also when they actually do seek help, they're not alienated because of these cultural miscommunication gaps. So, for example, Asian American culture tends to be interdependent, whereas Eurocentric culture, which is what American values emphasize, is all about the individual. And so we have two different conceptions of happiness. And a lot of times the healthcare system, not just mental health, assumes that relatives are a nuisance. So I have four other illnesses in addition to bipolar disorder, and they're not psychiatric in nature, but one of them is a rare form of muscular dystrophy for which I carry a cane. And I was debating having this surgery that I ended up having. It was like all surgeries, it was painful, and I didn't know if I wanted to have it because I didn't know if it would work. So to put yourself through pain for something that may not work. And I think for me, it was normal. I took my mom to the consultation, and the doctor was looking at her suspiciously the whole time, you know, and I didn't indicate that I didn't want my mom there. I wanted her there for moral support. And he's like, you know, this is her decision. Like, he was very antagonistic towards her. And that happens in mental health too. So if you go into your first therapist appointment, or you get a diagnosis and somebody is acting or talking like that about your family as a whole, you might not come back. And so understanding that it's not that anyone's right or wrong, and just understanding where those gaps are so mental health professionals can bridge them is very important.
Mm-hmm. And Emily, due to your outreach with the Asian American community, what have you seen in terms of gaps in services, and also just, you know, how Asian Americans are underserved in terms of mental health services? What have you seen in your work?
Mm-hmm. Like, one thing that the mental health system will try to do if they have any prevention and early intervention efforts is being able to translate brochures, documents into the languages of the immigrant communities. And sometimes I think it's hard for the mental health system to even hire enough clinicians who are from that culture to be able to speak in the same language as those underserved communities. But the thing is, also, I like to stress when I'm advocating is that translating the materials is important, but if the stigma is going to be so strong with the adult population, immigrants, then how are their children supposed to get any help? And this is why I've been so big on trying to get the education system, like, wondering when is the topic of mental health going to be normalized more often in schools, and so that kids can learn the coping skills at an earlier age, so that, you know, that's the prevention and early intervention, I think. Like, just being able to normalize these conversations so that we can have better coping skills and they can be able to utilize that when they're much older and pass that on to the next generation. So, I mean, when you spoke of model minority myth, I mean, like, I, in high school, I did take peer counseling, and it was a really good class because they would, you know, teach us how to, say, make I statements and learning how to communicate with other people. And later on, when after I graduated, you know, I asked, like, oh, is peer counseling still offered at your school? And they said no because of budget cuts. And I thought that class was really helpful because even the teacher was almost like a counselor to me. And, but even at that time, you know, even earlier in junior high, like, I was showing signs of sadness, depression. I wrote a poem about a depressed little boy, you know, yearning for love. And my teacher didn't say a thing. And so, you know, even education, school administrators, teachers, like, they don't all know the signs. And like Jessica said earlier, sometimes adults think like, oh, this is just a phase, you know. And sometimes, you know, it helps when students have someone to be able to talk to and get that help when they need them so they don't fall through the cracks, you know. And when they fall through the cracks, that's how they become unserved and underserved.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
I did have a positive experience years ago, very contrasting to my experience with my cousin. I was 24, and I'd been going to that church that I spoke about. At that time, the pastor was gone, who said it was nothing. And our pastor at the time had a daughter with bipolar disorder, and he had gone through NAMI training. He was all about, you know, mental health awareness and seeking help and understanding, but I had grown up there, and some of those families, they knew me since I was a child, or they knew my family since before I was born, and they didn't know I had bipolar disorder. And when I was getting baptized in front of the church, I talked about my mental health struggles, and I didn't experience any shame, and lots of people came up to me afterwards sharing their stories. You know, my niece has bipolar disorder, or I've had depression. So it, you know, representation is important, seeing your story and just even someone with your a face similar to yours in a mental health campaign is so important because it takes away some of the shame.
Agreed. I think that's what's, you know, so powerful to see you and you too being so visible and being out there, because hopefully it'll give, you know, Asian Americans and, you know, all people, you know, a sense that they identify with you, and whether they choose to, you know, disclose, whether they choose to talk about who they are, whether they choose to seek help, you know, hopefully, you know, that's, you know, you will all influence them in terms of saying that you're not alone. And I think that's one of the biggest struggles, is that most people really do feel alone. So before we wrap up, I just want to, you know, ask both of you, you know, for somebody who's out there who's Asian American, who's, you know, experiencing a mental health disability, a mental illness, maybe for the first time, but just, you know, really in the early phases, what's your advice for them? What do you want to say to them in terms of how they might approach their families, how, you know, what kind of message do you want to share?
So I think there's a couple things. First, we can engage in awareness, but often cultures don't change overnight. So we can't control other people's actions. You know, my parents did come around relatively quickly, you know, but we can control our actions. So if your family isn't supportive right now, still get help, because your life is more important. Just because things feel hopeless, it doesn't necessarily mean it is hopeless.
Thank you for that, Jessica. How about you, Emily?
I told a group of college students that, you know, sometimes we all have different love languages, and, you know, maybe our parents are not able to communicate with us in the way that we want them to love us, but just because they don't love you the way that you need them to doesn't mean that they don't love you at all. They love you the way that they know best given how they grew up. And I think that that was what I misunderstood when I was growing up with my parents. I thought that love was a certain way, but they didn't love me in that way, so I didn't feel loved. And so that's why, even with after disclosing, it can be really tough when your parents don't, your family or your friends don't understand. But, you know, it's so important to get that help and find that family outside your family. John Lennon said, being honest may not get you a lot of friends, but it will get you the right ones.
Okay, oh, one more thing I wanted to share, or a couple things that are important, I think. First, what I talked about this on my website. I had an interview with expert Lillian Shin. It's called 5 Tips How Asian Americans and Mental Health Professionals Can Build Family Support. Is that if we talk to our family in terms of somatic symptoms, it makes them easier to understand depression. I constantly have back aches and tummy aches and my head hurts. That goes a long way. Also, I have this on my website, but I'd love it if you could post this on your website too. We have suicide hotlines in other languages now, which is amazing. You know, it's important if you're feeling suicidal, or, you know, you have a family member, maybe a mom who's feeling suicidal and she doesn't speak English. So there's the Asian LifeNet hotline. Cantonese, Mandarin, Japanese, Korean, Fujianese are available. The number for the Asian LifeNet hotline is 1-877-990-8585. And then the 24-hour National Suicide Prevention Hotline, a lot of people don't know this, it comes in over 150 languages. 150 languages. And the number for the National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 1-800-273-TALK.
That's awesome. Thank you. Well, Emily, Jessica, I am tremendously grateful for you too, and for all the work that you both do. And I think this makes our disability community stronger. It makes our Asian community stronger. It makes the mental health community stronger. And I'm just so thankful for you to be in our world.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
This podcast is a production of the Disability Visibility Project, an online community dedicated to creating, sharing, and amplifying disability media and culture. All episodes, including text transcripts, are available at disabilityvisibilityproject.com/podcast. You'll also find more links about Emily and Jessica on our website. The audio producer for this episode is Geraldine Asu. The introduction by Latif McLeod. The music by Wilter Sports Camp. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. If you enjoyed this episode and want to support disabled media, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/DVP. That's patreon.com/DVP. Every little bit of assistance is appreciated. Well, thanks for listening, and see you on the internet. Bye! Rock into the blast off, stop, drop, dance off.